the Stu Peters Show. There's no doubt that if you follow me on social media, whether it's Twitter or Instagram, you saw some recent posts, specifically yesterday, that were teasing an appearance from somebody today who has major revelations, significant allegations about court corruption. Now, we've often said on this program that if we don't have the courts, we have nothing. The judiciary is no doubt full of questionable or even nefarious actors, as proven by a recent expose that we aired after an investigative interview with an attorney in Florida called Wayne Ferguson. That video has over 500,000 collective views. That's over 500,000. And we can say with almost certainty that his case, with multi-billion dollar bankruptcy level implications, has been brought to the attention of Governor Ron DeSantis. He's a JAG himself. When whistleblowers come to me with allegations of corruption, collusion, or immoral actions by those in positions of authority, influence, elected power, we take these very seriously, specifically when they come with significant documentation. I was recently contacted by a Florida attorney called Dove Sussman. Sussman said to me in a private message, quote, "We have a civil rights case against four judges. One judge sexually harassed my client. There are witnesses." Of course, that caught my attention. Sussman continued by saying that this judge placed himself on his client's lawsuit and, quote, took her homestead property as a sanction. Think about that. Took her home, seized her home as a sanction. Allegedly for not participating in this sexual quid pro quo, which we will ask her about. Sussman continued with allegations about inappropriate ex parte communications, and even more seriously, a circuit court judge who was allegedly caught trying to influence a sitting appellate court judge to rule against his client. His client is Terry Gaffney. Gaffney is an attorney herself, practices in tax law, and she joins us now. Terry, these are really serious allegations that you're making. Welcome to the Stu Peters Show. Take us through this.
So I'll start at the beginning. And what had happened was, and which is quite interesting, is I sit on what's called the Judicial Nominating Commission. And so when a judge resigns, retires, or dies in between his elected term, the group I'm on, we select judges to go up to the governor, who then selects the nominee to fill the seat. That's important because that's how the story starts. And in December of 15, we were selecting someone to be sent up to the governor. First election. And these people give us references to call. So we call them, you know, to see what kind of person this applicant would be. And one of the references for an applicant was a judge by the name of Paul Huey, who I never had met, never had spoken to. And I'm a tax attorney, so I'm really boring. I dot my I's, cross my T's, and I'm no nonsense. Been married for 34 years, have two kids, great kids. My son's in the military. So I start with asking Judge Huey my standard questions about this particular applicant. And then the conversation took a turn into hell when the judge basically started propositioning me, saying things like, hey, let's go have lunch. Let's become a power couple. Are you happy in your marriage? He had some deficiency in his marriage. And it was getting weird. So I had him on speaker so I could take notes about the applicant, not this nonsense. And so some people, I guess, seeing my face, walked in and they're all shocked at this judge's comments, which started to get very graphic of what he wanted to do. He was basically, he wanted a relationship. He then...
graphic in what way? And how were they graphic? And how many witnesses were there?
There were two people who had walked in, and he... basically wanted to have basically oral sex. And that was where it came down to. And it was like his wife was deficient and he wasn't happy. And my point was, this is inappropriate. Let's just get down to why I'm calling you. I don't want to hang up on you. Please stop it. And then he attacked Governor Scott. At the time, Senator Scott was then Governor Scott, and started saying derogatory stuff about him. Then went on after then Attorney General Pam Bondi, kept saying very derogative things about her, things you don't talk about women and should never. And he said, if you don't, I will get you. I will ruin your reputation. I'm coming after you. And that's kind of strange. And I said, sir, this conversation's over. I'm sorry. I don't mean to hang up, but we're done. At the time, I was involved in some litigation, which dealt with two attorneys who sued me because they had tried to put my father into a guardianship, and they represented the my two sisters who had been disinherited by my father because they had stole money from my dad. And these attorneys actually helped steal the money from my father. They wanted more money, so they turn around and sue me. I didn't inherit anything from my dad, but they said, oh, well, you can afford to pay our fees that your sisters never paid. So they're suing me in a meritless case. So lo and behold, Judge Huey becomes the judge on my case. In the interim, he had called some attorneys asking about me. And then at the first hearing he's involved in, he implies that we had a relationship. He also says, I can ruin your reputation. And he says, you live in Romney world. Nothing made sense.
Now, hold on a second. He implied that you had a relationship. In what way? How did he imply that?
He was saying in court, because we have the transcript, he goes, I know Terry Gaffney and she knows me.
He said this on the record.
Yeah, we have the transcript. So it's not like, you know, there's no doubt what was said.
Sure.
And
was
and
he so doing that for purposes of disclosure to let everybody know that, hey, we know each other. We want this on the record so that just to be clear, or was he referencing some sort of an advanced relationship between the two of you?
The impression was an advanced relationship.
Okay. So that's speculation, but that's what you're... Okay.
Yeah. And then he also put on that he could ruin my reputation.
He said that on the record.
Correct. And that is in the transcript. And lo and behold, that same day, he meets with opposing counsel in another hearing, and they had talked about my case. And you say, well, how would you know that? Well, they were stupid enough to put it in the order that they had discussed my case. Then out of the blue, he issues this terrible sanctions order that I was this horribly bad person, and strikes my pleadings and does all sorts of stuff. And I file my affidavit saying, this is what you did, and you need the people, you can't be on my case. Well, he gets off my case, and then this other judge gets on, his name is Rex Barbas, and refuses to allow us to have witnesses, refused to allow us to have testimony, and says on the record he had no problem with what Judge Huey did. And now, at this time, everybody knows what Judge Huey did. He won't let my witnesses testify as to what Judge Huey did, and he strikes all of my pleadings. And although the final order says there was a hearing, there was no hearing that we went to because it was not in the docket. He takes my homestead property in violation, or actually the family's homestead property in violation of the Constitution of the state of Florida. And lo and behold, everybody admits the case was always meritless because it was filed after statute of limitations. There was no subject matter jurisdiction, no standing. And I know those are legal technical terms, but the judges, opposing counsel, and expert witnesses all said the case lacked merit and should have been dismissed. And even Judge Huey later tells some people, oh, the case should have been dismissed. Subsequent to the taking of our property, and we were evicted, they came to our house one day and evicted us. And in the process, two of my cats got out, they were killed, and then my dog overheated and died. And they wouldn't let me take my personal possessions. We could hear them smashing things. And I'd called some people to come over and everyone could hear them smashing things in my home.
Who was smashing things?
The two attorneys were there, Kangas and Bowman, and two deputies. And one deputy even testified, I did get out the rest of the cats. There were some other cats. And he said he was just going to lock them in there. He didn't care about getting them out. And he testified to that under oath. They have no regard to what was going on. They never looked at the fact that this was homestead property. The sheriff's office has admitted that. They just took our house. And you can't do that under the Constitution, especially to pay legal fees that aren't mine, that were my disinherited sisters. So subsequent to that, Judge Barbas admitted on the record that he took the homestead property as a sanction, which you cannot do. And then he was caught at an ends of court meeting sitting next to a second district court of appeal judge in November of 2019. And he's trying to have this judge rule against us. He's saying very negative things about us and said, you know, basically don't rule for them. sitting there were attorneys, and they have actually done affidavits. You saw, I sent you one of them.
I'm just reviewing it now. Yes. I've looked at it before, but I was just re-going over all of the documentation that you had sent me as you were talking here, because obviously it helps me to follow along, you know, to make sure that everything that, okay, go ahead.
And so this attorney who sent this, who called me and told me about it and did this affidavit, is not an interested party. He's not an attorney for me. He just is doing the right thing. Okay. And he heard this Judge Barba say, trying to influence an appellate judge. 2 days after this meeting, in a court hearing, which is the next affidavit I sent you, Judge Barbas is talking on the record, not on the record, but just talking in court, saying, I've talked to six judges about Gaffney's case. Well, that means I can't get a fair appellate hearing, nor can I get a fair hearing anywhere, because he's trying to influence other judges to rule against me. And a circuit court judge is not allowed to get involved in the appellate process. And that's a real problem. And so and then Judge Barbas gets off the case and we think, oh, this is great. So we get this, he, in violation of the administrative orders, Judge Barbas then disqualifies himself, gets off the case, and then selects Judge Tishy Arkin to get on the case instead of having the clerk do it, which would be random and might get a judge who actually would follow the law. She, in her order, says that, oh, this case is meritless, but I'm still assessing fees and I'm not returning the property. So I got hit with attorney's fees on a meritless case. And it's all because I refused to have sex with the judge, and they're covering up for their friend.
And so where can't do that. So where is this now?
It's on appeal at the Second District Court of Appeal, but we probably are going to have to move for a change of venue and let the Florida Supreme Court know what's going on. And then a federal civil rights case has been filed in federal court because of the violations of the Constitution. In Florida, homestead property is sacrosanct. You can't take it for nonsensical reasons, and you can't alter the Constitution. So what they're doing is they violated the Constitution of the state of Florida. And that's a due process argument. So that's why we're in federal court.
Okay. So just to make clear on all of this. So you sent me a very detailed chronological kind of outline order of events for your case. You're a tax Correct. Attorney. You're obviously very familiar with being scrupulous to details. You also sent me two of these sworn affidavits. You sent me a synopsis, kind of the things that I need to know for the purpose of conducting an interview today. What you did not provide me with was the order that originally ordered the seizure of the property from the 13th Judicial Circuit of Hillsborough County. Is there a reason why you omitted that?
I was trying to give you a brief. No, I have no problem submitting it. I have no problem because that order violates the Constitution in and of its face, because the start of that order states that at a hearing dated, and the hearing date is missed, the following was discussed, and there was no hearing. In fact, this order.
And why was there no hearing?
We don't know. I can't get an answer. And so basically that is a question my attorneys will ask in the federal civil rights case, because under the law, a hearing was required.
It says here that the court waited 30 minutes for the defendants, being you, but nobody showed.
No, that is a hearing. So what happened is, back in February 2016, we moved to disqualify Huey based on his information. And in 2016, we moved to disqualify him. At that point, all hearings had to be canceled. Judge Huey goes ahead and has a hearing, again, without noticing us. So it's been a sub rosa type of situation where they have these hearings but don't notice us.
Okay. So it says that defendants Gaffney and Sussman, you were notified the property was deeded between Gaffney and Sarah Sussman and or the Sussman Family Trust, and that the plaintiff has raised issues as to the legality of those transfers. So that's a completely separate mm-hmm. thing right there. But it says that you have willfully and intentionally frustrated the plaintiff's attempts to justly, speedily, and inexpensively prosecute the case, that you have disregarded the court's authority, the rules regulating the Florida bar, and the rules of civil procedure. This order finds you in contempt of court.
Yes, and that is correct. But the fact is that none of that occurred, and we can prove it by the docket. They keep saying that I missed a deposition when I have the transcript of that deposition.
Yeah, it says here that you refused to cooperate in scheduling a deposition, that you waited 33 days, and then one day before your scheduled deposition, you filed a motion for protective order. The court later then found that there was no legal basis for that protective order.
That actually happened under a previous attorney, and that's a very interesting point. That attorney, I just would prefer not to mention his name because of his
problems. I will. His name is Stuart Levine.
Correct. That's the attorney.
Yes. And he withdrew himself, correct?
Yes. He was terminated.
Okay.
What happened was I, as I said, was on the Judicial Nominating Commission. So Mr. Kangas sets my deposition while we're convening to meet with to select a judge. I was unaware of it. Mr. Levine subsequently admitted that he never bothered to tell me about that deposition.
Okay. So that
was why I then went to the next deposition that was scheduled and attended it.
Right.
Mr. Levine admitted that he hadn't told me. And there was a notice of clarification filed in the court saying I wasn't told.
I don't think I've ever seen an order written in this way. This judge went over and above to articulate all of the reasons why this is happening, including saying that you waited for 33 days. You made no attempt to communicate with the plaintiff's counsel in an effort to reschedule the deposition. This is after Levine is gone. And then it says the motion for protective order failed to allege any legal basis for a protective order, despite not even trying to get a hearing on the motion, that you did not appear for the scheduled deposition. Further, neither you nor your counsel made in any attempt or good faith or otherwise to reschedule the deposition for a mutually agreeable date prior to the protective order being unilaterally scheduled. Neither the defendant, you, nor your counsel made any attempt to schedule the motion for protective order for the hearing prior. I mean, this thing goes on saying that there's evidence here of your intent to delay the resolution of the matter.
Now, that again is with Mr. Levine. I was unaware of all of this. And if you go back into the file, he admits that he never told me. He did the protective order. I did not. I was unaware of it. As soon as I became aware, less than 6 months later, my deposition's been taken.
Okay. And so then it says regarding your counsel that the plaintiff's counsel emailed your counsel in August seeking a mutually agreeable date and time for your deposition. But they never responded to those emails. After suffering further delay from the refusal to schedule your deposition, counsel filed a motion to compel discovery. Just 3 hours after the plaintiff's counsel requested that defendant's counsel, your counsel, clear time for a hearing on the motion to compel discovery, your counsel filed a notice of unavailability, stating that he was not available for the first 15 days of the following month. So is there any reason why you would have responded in such a timely fashion to that motion to compel, but not for the deposition?
Because there were different attorneys.
Okay. And that's, as you can see, I'm trying to get things straight because you're making very serious allegations here.
Yes, I am.
And I didn't have, you know, this documentation. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is when Mr. Sussman, your attorney, sent me a message, you know, asking, hey, would your platform be interested in exposing this corruption? Mm-hmm. I have a client here who has been sexually harassed. There's been significant injustice done, all of those things. Mr. Sussman failed to tell me, and during our phone conversation, you did not tell me that there's a relationship between you and your attorney, which is the two of you are married.
That is correct, because I fired Mr. Levine. You don't find that important? No, not really. He's an attorney, and I let go. I fired Mr. Levine, I'm paying $90,000 a month in legal fees, which I can no longer afford. And my husband was retired, took over and took over the case. There's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. However, it did come up because you use this attorney-client privilege thing, you know, to later refuse to answer questions on the record. But there is no attorney-client privilege when that relationship exists.
I'm not sure that that's there is the question that was asked to me was I actually helped my father obtain attorneys for the guardianship matter that Mr. Bowman and Mr. Kangas sued my father under. And that's where it comes out of. They wanted to know what my conversation was with my father. Well, that's an attorney-client privilege, and you can't answer that question. What Judge Yui and everyone has failed to state in that is at the time that Mr. Kangas and Mr. Bowman are suing me, they're also suing my father's estate. So they are both representing and suing the estate of my dad.
And you know, because, you know, I'm trying to get this right. I mean, there are millions of people that are extremely frustrated with our judiciary. Specifically as it relates to, a presidential election, that courts have failed to hear cases on, that there are people waiting in line for months to get before the court. Mm-hmm. And so when you're making allegations like this, I want to make sure that we're being 100% candid, which is why I'm wondering why the omission of this particular order. In this order, as a footnote, the judge says that in 14 plus years on the bench, this was the first time an attorney refused to get on the phone with a court in an effort to schedule a matter for hearing.
And what's interesting about that is our receptionist at the office actually did an affidavit because the judge never called the office. We keep telephone logs of every recorded call in and out, and there was no record of a Judge Yui ever calling the office. The receptionist on her own, when I showed her, I said, "You didn't give a call." And she did an affidavit saying there was no telephone call by Judge Yui.
So in public records, there are, hundreds of filings relating to this case and several others that you and, now I know him to be your husband, your attorney, have filed. Mm-hmm. And now as recently as just a couple of weeks ago, less than 2 weeks ago, there is now another lawsuit that you have filed. There was also a public document here, which is the opinion of a federal bankruptcy court judge. And this judge heard about this, and it appears to me that this judge this is, I believe, an 11-page opinion, which is extremely long, went into great detail outside of their responsibility to highlight all of the reasons why your case, why the claim was deemed to be invalid about this homestead claim.
And they're not following. And I would like to tell you that they're not following the law. And what you have just uncovered is what's going on. And that is why so many attorneys are coming out and doing affidavits and willing to testify, because I made an accusation and I have alleged that a judge sexually harassed me. You are following what is known as their closing ranks, and they're not going over. And this is what's happening. And they're all that sanctions order, which you quote, which is great. If you look at it, Judge Yui in there says, "Oh, I forgive what Stuart Levine did." Well, he's the culprit of everything that happened. Not me. He was the attorney of record. He never bothered to tell me. You can't exonerate the attorney for what he did and then blame the client. That's not right.
How many attorneys did you have have you had throughout the course of this case?
Well,
other than your husband.
The civil rights attorneys that are currently on there, Mr. Levine, and on that case, and that's really basically it. In other cases, I've had to hire other attorneys for other issues, but on this case, that's it.
Have you gone to other attorneys who have said that they don't want to take this case?
No.
So people are willing to take it, but you, for whatever reason, you're sticking with?
Well, it's because it costs too much money. When you get in this type of situation, you can't afford to have to keep hiring attorneys. Attorneys are expensive.
So the allegation here is that basically you negatively responded to a sexual quid pro quo from a judge.
who wasn't on my case at the time, and lo and behold, gets on my case, which is even more interesting.
And you're citing that as the reason why your property was seized.
That's what they said. That's what Judge Barba said. He said, I took your homestead property as a sanction.
Okay. It says here that the sanction was because of contempt.
But it's a little over the top. Even if I did miss a deposition that I actually attended, taking homestead property is a little over the top. That's what expert witnesses will testify to.
But the court is claiming that it's not a homestead property, and they're alleging that that property was transferred fraudulently.
Which is, then you have to go back to the bottom line, and that's why they won't let my witnesses testify. Mr. Kangas and Mr. Bowman, we have the copies of the checks they stole from my father. My father, before he died, did a verified affidavit stating that Mr. Bowman created a phony trust and had taken money from him. So if I win this case, Mr. Kangas and Mr. Bowman have to pay back $1 million they stole. We have the copies of checks. We have the bank statements. We have the stock brokerage accounts, all that's been filed. We also have affidavits from my father's own personal attorneys who said that Mr. Bowman had been taking money from my father. My father's other attorney also put in emails that said they were taking money from my father.
So this bankruptcy court judge, and I'm assuming that this was in bankruptcy as part of the litigation, the attempt to fight against the seizure of this homestead property.
Correct.
Is that right? Okay.
Correct.
So this judge says, although the debtor, you, is correct that the final judgment does not include an express adjudication of debtor's homestead claim, debtor ignores what actually occurred in the state court. And then there's a footnote to that that says that your characterization of the final judgment as a default judgment is misleading. The judgment was entered after the state court sanctioned the defendant, including you, by striking their answers and affirmative defenses. Can you explain that?
No, actually, because it doesn't make sense. And what's really more interesting is we now have Judge Tishy Arkin, as well as opposing counsel, saying that the case was meritless when it was filed. They didn't file it in good faith. They have a false probate order that they said allowed them to seize my property. What the probate order says is they are to go after the assets of the estate. If you go back to my father's will, the assets of the estate, my father died penniless. Because Mary Alice Tyler, along with Phil Bowman, took money from my dad. That's in his will. And those are the assets of the estate.
I mean, they went over and above here, it looks like. I mean, they even subpoenaed your work records as to when you were at work.
No, they didn't.
Which would have been in Washington, D.C., correct?
No, that is Sarah.
Your daughter.
So, correct.
Okay. And she is the one who filed for this bankruptcy.
That is correct.
Okay. And so she said that she was in Florida when in fact she was not. She was in D.C., according to this opinion written by a federal judge.
That is not what that opinion says. And you're mischaracterizing it. She took a class, which you have to take, a credit counseling course, through a VPN computer. And she right now, my computer says I'm not where I am because I have VPN on it. It says I'm somewhere else because we run it through a server or a router, something to that effect that allows you to be what you want. And that's what we did because the guy who does my IT, and there's an affidavit in there that he set those up as a VPN.
But hold on. You're accusing me of mischaracterizing. I'm not doing that. I'm reading an opinion written by a federal court judge. So if there's any mischaracterization going on here, please allow me to say, that's not me. I'm reading directly from...
Oh, I know. But she never listened. You have to understand, it's the cone of silence. I went after a judge, and so I don't get a fair hearing. And that's the whole problem that we've had. The case was meritless. The case should have been dismissed because it was filed after the statute of limitations run, no subject matter jurisdiction, and there's no standing.
So going back to what I started when you told me that, yes, I was mischaracterizing.
Correct.
This says, as detailed above, the certificate filed with the court indicates that this credit counseling course was taken via the internet on October 23rd, 2017 mm-hmm. at 7:35 p.m. The course provider's records indicate that the IP address from which the course was taken place at the Connected Computer in Tampa, Florida. And at that time, the debtor, your daughter, was in Washington, D.C. and clocked in at work. These facts are not disputed and are established by the evidence proffered by the administrator.
That is what the administrator proffered. But what the judge never considered was my daughter's boss sent an email stating that she went to take the class and she was allowed to leave and he didn't make her clock out. So that was in the record that the judge never considered. The next part about it is she took the course, and the judge actually admits she took the course, but she said she didn't take it at that time.
So you contested that.
Yes.
Okay. And so then the question that I would have, again, just trying to get everything correct right here. Prior to the trial on the contested matters, the court held a 3-day evidentiary hearing. I've never heard of such a thing. 3-day evidentiary hearing. That is incredibly long.
Not really.
Relative to debtor's failure to preserve electronically stored information. So did you destroy the computer?
No. And I'll tell you the story about that. That's even more interesting. Sarah, my daughter, had the computer. It was an old one because she wasn't using it for work. So it was pretty beat up. She took the class in October. The computer was freezing and hard doing anything. And so in November, it died. So I said, you can get rid of the computer. You can get rid of the hard drive. I have no problem, but remember to smash it up so there's nothing there. This is in November. No one has talked about preservation of evidence or anything to that effect. She does. I didn't realize she took out the hard drive, but she kept the shell because apparently you can reuse a shell. What's even more interesting, and there is an affidavit in the file, there's a man by the name of Gunther Sanabria who moves across from my daughter in D.C. Gunther Sanabria works for Michael Kangas, the attorney for the administrator. My daughter's apartment keeps getting broken into, but nothing seems to ever be missing. She had left the shell of the laptop in a suitcase. Doesn't think about anything about it because all she's finding is this window open. We have an affidavit from a private investigator who found that Mr. Sanabria, in a city of 62,500 people, moves across the street from her January 2018 and leaves after she leaves. In May of 2018, Mr. Sanabria goes up to my daughter in D.C. and says, I'm from Michael Kangas, and grabs her and starts dragging her. And she gets away through help of somebody else. Now, that's far-fetched as you can get, except for Mr. Kangas put in court documents that he texted Mr. Sanabria at 7:58 p.m. and 45 minutes later on May, I think, 8th or 9th of 2018, before and after he assaulted my daughter. And then in May of 2018, Mr. Kangas is saying, I want to see the computer. My daughter says, oh, I have it. Because she has the hard shell, but she doesn't have, she has the shell, but she says, I don't have the hard drive. She goes to where it's stored, and all are left a couple keys, nothing else. A little odd. And it's interesting that the man who assaulted her is also the man who moved in across the street.
How many judges have ruled on this or heard this case?
The three that I'm suing, basically, and then the bankruptcy judge, which we haven't sued. Because that's not a part of the civil rights case.
That's the federal bankruptcy judge that wrote this opinion.
Correct. And partially because the case is fraudulent and we now have the fraud. And there's the basic question you have to ask is, why did a circuit court judge feel the need to try to influence a sitting appellate judges? That's really the question. Why do they feel the need to do it? And is this something they're doing over and over and over? And that's a concern everybody should have.
The affidavits are pretty vague. They don't really specifically say that the circuit court judge was attempting to influence the decision of an appellate court judge, only that they were talking.
You can't talk about a case, nor can you make remarks about an attorney.
So you can't say, oh, here comes the woman who accused this judge of sexual assault.
No,
you're not allowed to say any of that. And that might be. I'm not an attorney. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, you can't say that.
You said that the simple question that we have to ask is what?
Why would a sitting circuit court judge feel the need to sit down and ask an appellate judge, thank you for not ruling for them, and start disparaging people?
So the case was already dismissed at this point?
Yes, he had already dismissed it, and it was on appeal.
Okay. Prior to this, so this federal court judge is accusing you of destroying evidence.
But
this bankruptcy court judge.
There was no evidence destroyed. It was removed. And it was removed, and we can't find it. And the only logical conclusion comes in that the gentleman who assaults my daughter is also the person who lived across the street from her, had to have taken it, because it makes no sense. And honestly, if we had been dishonest because the hard drive had been destroyed, I could have taken any old computer and said, here it is. But we didn't do it. We told the truth. And that's the difference between me and the opposing counsel and what's been going on. And what the problem is, and I will tell you, once you say something bad about a judge, you can't get a fair hearing anywhere. I have a retired judge who's reviewed this and has come to the totally that the judges here have acted in concert to deprive me of my civil rights.
So at the top of the conversation, when I asked you why you didn't tell me that your attorney was your husband, I find it relevant. Mm-hmm. You seem to dismiss that as being relevant. And I'm not here to grill you, but there's overwhelming documentation here that doesn't support what you're saying. This alleges that the transfer of the deed was done fraudulently, that it is not indeed a homestead property, and that's why the property was taken as a sanction, not anything to do with a blowjob. And then it further says that you intentionally delayed the court over and over again, and then you used that attorney-client privilege when the communication sought relevant to an issue between two parties who claim through the same decedent. So according to the Florida statute 90.5024B, there is no attorney-client privilege when that communication is happening.
Except for you're wrong in the sense, because
I'm not wrong. I'm not wrong. I'm reading.
Oh, no. All right. Mr. Kangas is suing my father's estate as well as suing me. He's both representing and suing the state. I got a hotline opinion that said because of his conflict, I was not permitted to divulge any of the communications between my father and me.
Okay, and that's what I want to get to. So the defendant argued that she obtained an opinion from the Florida Bar Ethics Hotline that the information was sought was privileged, and she refused to answer on that basis. Okay. As an aside, she never followed up to get in a written opinion. At the conclusion of the arguments, the court overruled your objection based on the attorney-client privilege and directed you to answer the question. The court directed you to answer the question. Notwithstanding that court's ruling, you still refused to answer the question.
Correct, because that was part of an appeal that we were about to take. So partially what you keep saying that we distracted, what you don't, and then I'll go ahead and send you all the emails Mr. Levine sent to Mr. Kangas, where he gave Mr. Kangas an opportunity to do a deposition in April, and Mr. Kangas sets it in March. So if you want to sit there and make all these arguments, all those documents were filed. And Mr. Levine,
I'm not making arguments. I'm in search of the truth, and I'm permitted to do that on my show.
Oh, I know you are. And okay. I'm not arguing with you, but I'm telling you there's more to the story.
And I'm not omitting anything. If anything was omitted, you omitted this. You didn't give me relevant documentation. I had to go look for these orders in a slew of documentation. That's not an accidental oversight, in my opinion. That's an intentional omission. Important documentation that you failed to provide me for the purpose of deception.
I'm not deceiving you. I have no problem showing you those documents.
It appears to me that you have tried to mislead me, to mislead this show in an effort to use its platform in a desperate move of return of property that you claim to be homestead, but indeed it's not. It's my opinion that along with the intentional deception you attempted here, you attempted this in circuit court as well as federal bankruptcy court, which is clearly stated by a very long and articulately written opinion by a federal court judge.
Well, unfortunately, that's not the law. And what you're missing is it was homestead property. There was one expert witness who got to testify that said it was homestead property. And there's never been an adverse ruling in state court that it was homestead property.
Okay. Well, as again, I said, those are my opinions. And
no, that's okay.
It's my opinion that there are people in line with real court cases. They wait for months to be heard. And that it would appear here by multiple judges who you say are all colluding. Federal court judges, circuit court judges, civil rights court judges. I didn't say that.
I'm telling you, when you have the federal court judge relies on.
You said
the
state. There was a cone of silence.
There is a cone of silence.
Okay, so you're suggesting that they are all colluding.
Well, yeah, they are in a lot of ways.
Well, you just said that they weren't. But now you're saying that they are. You understand, at best, this is misleading. Fraudulent, more likely. But participating in contemptuous practice, absolutely.
There was no contemptuous practice, Mr. Peters.
It says it right here. It's in the order that the court found you in contempt. Furthermore, there were sanctions from the Florida bar against your attorney, Dove Sussman, who's also your attorney that you didn't tell me was your husband.
That was over 15 years ago, is a minor public reprimand. So basically, I'm actually surprised, because when you look at the facts and the record, it is not what you're implying.
I'm looking at everything that I was provided to by you. And then I'm looking at what's publicly accessible, written by a court, written by the judge, in an order, very long orders, two of them, one of them by a federal court judge, one of them who says in 11 years he's never seen anything like this, and another one who went out of her way, this federal court bankruptcy judge, who probably could have sanctioned you in a lot more ways, but seemed to have been very tactful in the way that she wrote this, almost as a warning, like she felt bad for you, or maybe more your daughter.
Sir, I will send you more documentation then, because you need to see more of it. Because that sanctions order, I've had people review it.
I will wait for that documentation, and I will be more than happy to have you back. Your allegations are very serious. I take them very seriously. The Me Too movement is not just something that somebody says. Every single woman, and let me be very clear here, every woman deserves to be heard on allegations like that. However,
I have witnesses, and I also have Judge Huey making an admission against interest that he did what he said.
I don't have that. You did not provide that to me.
Because those are witnesses who've never been allowed to testify.
They could come here.
They will.
We will look forward to that. My audience has a strong desire for the truth. And if you want to bring it here, I am more than happy to broadcast that truth anywhere. I would ask that please do not omit documentation like this and insult my intelligence or my due diligence. I'm going to go find it. This is very appropriate. This is very relevant information. You say that they killed cats, but yet nobody could remember the cat's name, suggesting that these were feral animals. I mean, this is all written inside of this order, and I believe that you intentionally withheld this because you didn't want me to know that there was information that was damning to your position.
No, you asked me to make it very brief, sir. You asked me to send you a very brief bullet point, 3 to 5 points. I quite remember our conversation. So
you omitted quite possibly the most important pieces of evidence, the most important pieces of relevant information as it pertaining to your case. And that would be an order from a district court judge who you are alleging of a sexual quid pro quo.
No, that's not. It's not a district court judge. It's a circuit court judge.
Circuit court judge. It's signed by the judge that you're accusing of demanding sexual favors in exchange for a positive or favorable outcome in your case, who then you claim took your property as a result of your decline to participate in said sexual activity.
That is correct.
That's not what it says here.
Because why would they put that in the order, sir?
So you're saying that not only this judge, who didn't put that in the order, he of course did not put in the order, I am seizing her property because she refused
to
have oral sex with me. Then two other circuit court judges and a federal court judge are all colluding under this cone of silence against you. To protect him in these actions.
Yeah, I think
you have witnesses that will come forward to say that.
Yes, I do.
When you have them, bring them to me and they will be heard.
Yes. I will send you some affidavits today, because that's the whole point. The sanctions order is also done to get me, just like he said.
If you now, have if proof you, of that, omitting that, when I said keep it brief, I didn't mean to omit every single thing that is excruciatingly relevant to this case.
Well, you asked me for 3 to 5 bullet points, and you said I assumed
I also spent 3 to 5 hours doing my own research, my own due diligence to verify who it was that I was going to be talking to.
Correct.
You were not forthcoming with me, and I don't appreciate that. I hope you will bring me the evidence that supports your claims, because there are a lot of people who are incredibly disenfranchised with our court system right now, specifically relating to a 2020 presidential election. People are very sensitive to our judicial system. They understand that without the courts, we have nothing. And with that, I have to go.
Oh, okay. I have it. All right.
Now, in a last-ditch effort to try to get my attention before the connection was interrupted, Ms. Gaffney accused me of being a sexist, saying that anytime somebody starts arguing with her, it's because that's what people like me want to do. People want to silence women. My producers were able to hit record again and catch the last part of that conversation. Don't pull that with me. Don't pull that with me. This isn't something I do to women. Okay.
No, but it's
this
just,
doesn't have anything whole... to do with what sex you are, what color you are, what your sexual orientation is, or how you politically align. I could care less. This has everything to do with facts.
Yes, and I've given you facts.
And you omitted facts, a lot of them.
Because you asked me to keep it brief. Why didn't you just call me and we could have gone over it?
Okay. Bring me the evidence and I'll be more than happy to give it to the people. The fact is, I will never omit facts. I will always dig for the truth. That was my promise to you at the inception of this show, and that will remain my focus. I will never apologize for that, and if I've hurt somebody's feelings, I will just remind you, facts do not care about feelings. If Ms. Gaffney wants to bring me the evidence to substantiate her claim, I'll be more than happy to bring that to you as well. No hard feelings. Also, I want you to know that these snakes out here who do intentionally mislead us, we know they mislead us every day, Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Barack Hussein Obama, the Clinton crime family. How about Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi? You can step on these snakes right now. Visit our new sponsor online, steponsocks.com. These are 3 pairs of high-quality Patriot-designed socks. That's right. This is like a rubbery, no-skid surface on the bottom of these things, and all of the names of your favorite people proudly displayed here so you can walk all over them all day long. Now, you can do it in secret. If your boss maybe is a liberal, a flaming progressive, no problem. You can hide it. Keep them inside of your boots or your shoes. Or you can do like I do and take your shoes off everywhere you go, kick your feet up on the desk or the table and show everybody that you're stepping on these snakes. Go to steponsocks.com right now. Get the Patriot Stoop Eaters discount. $17.76 for a 3-pack of these high-quality socks right now at steponsocks.com. There are, of course, many interesting, shocking, utterly nerve-wracking occurrences happening around the world, bombings, wars, etc. It would be impossible to dissect them all. Quite frankly, it would more than likely drive every sane person into some sort of clinical depression or other severe mental health diagnosis. It is, however, important to address concerning trends, newsworthy events that don't seem to be worthy of the news, as demonstrated by the lack of attention given to these eye-popping happenings. We don't know for certain if it's ignorance, failure to investigate, negligence, a lack of integrity, intentional cover-ups at worst, or politically motivated bias, but I'm speculating that it's more than likely all of the above. The fact is, when journalistic morality is completely absent in today's media, the responsible thing to do is turn to the experts. You more than likely have not heard through your news outlet, wherever it might be, that Ontario, Canada, one of the most restricted places on the planet, one of the world's most locked down civilizations as a result of the response to this COVID-19, has announced that it will now prohibit the use of the AstraZeneca injection, being falsely referred to as a vaccine. When I heard this, I thought it appropriate to go to an expert. So we now welcome Dr. Jane Ruby. She's an international health economist. She has over 20 years of pharmaceutical research experience. She's a Stu Peters Show contributor. We appreciate her being here. Dr. Ruby, I'm sure that you have heard this news. Do you have a theory?
I do, Stu, but let me share with the audience some of the background on this. Several days ago, we learned that the chief medical officer of Canada, Dr. David Williams, put a complete halt on the AstraZeneca injections. And he said that the reason for that was that they had learned of 8 cases of blood clots. Now, this is being now referred to as VITT, or vaccine-induced thrombosis thrombocytopenia, which is actually an oxymoronic term to mean at the same time you have blood clots being thrown and you're bleeding in other parts of your body. This is something we've talked about on the show a number of times as a result of these experimental injections. And he is saying, we're going to take a pause. He's actually minimizing it. I'm a little suspicious, to be honest with you, that an entire country the size of Canada, with its tight lockdowns and its super big pro-injection position, is going to stop one of the companies for 8 cases. Remember, they just recently in Canada opened up these experimental injections to 40-year-olds and up, where previously I believe it had been in the 50s or 60s. They're lowering their emergency use authorizations as well. And yet he's still pushing it. And I want people to remember, as we've covered on the show prior, that all 4 of the current experimental injections, gene therapy injections, that are under U.S. Emergency use authorization have been implicated in this phenomenon where people are developing blood clots very soon, like within days or weeks of getting these injections. And I'd like to share just a couple of new information that's come out. There was a 17-year-old boy, a teenager in Utah, who was hospitalized for having blood clots, perfectly healthy, no medical history, active in sports, got the injection, and I believe it was Pfizer, and he developed blood clots in his lungs and he's dead. The second one was a 35-year-old Michigan mother who also took the J&J injection, and she is she's actually passed away, deceased from her blood clots. The CDC has upped their number from 17, which is kind of a joke, to 23. But other sources are saying, and if you do a little bit of research on the VAERS section of the CDC website, some reports are showing up to 80,000 reports. Now, some of those could be in error. Those are made by patients and their families. But 80,000 is a huge safety signal for blood clots after, and this is after getting an injection across all 4 of these companies. So I wanted to make sure people understood that. And my theory, getting back to your question, is that a country like Canada, that's so large in population and land mass, is shutting down one of the companies for just 8 cases, or at least that they're representing 8 cases. Something else is going on here, Stu. I'm sure they have a lot more reported cases than just 8.
So what is your theory? What is the something else that might be going on? Is somebody covering up for something? Is somebody preparing for something?
Look, all we've seen, whether it's Canada, European countries, Asian countries, or here in the United States, is nothing but cover up, media, mainstream media, hiding things, sweeping under the rug. So I, as you know, I'm a little cautious about stating things with any absolutism until I really have evidence. I'm suspicious of it. It doesn't make sense. And we'll see what happens. He's claiming it's a pause, but he has halted the AstraZeneca injection 100%. How he cannot halt the other 3 companies is beyond me. And that's suspicious, too.
I'm going to speculate that it's in preparation for a massive amount of casualties. They're probably looking at the VAERS data here from the United States. They're probably covering up. The 8 is probably a very low number as to what real reporting is actually happening there. They're being labeled as something else so that they're not directly tied to these injections that are being referred to as vaccines. And I'm going to suggest that this is an attempt to wipe the blood off of the hands of those dictators, is what I would call them, that are ruling Canada. We see how locked down that country is. There was an SOS from the southern border, the northern border of the United States, southern border of Canada, to United States citizens saying, please help us. We see these Gestapo-style arrests of these pastors. Artur Pawlowski, who was a guest on this program, was hunted down. He and his brother taken into custody, imprisoned on a highway during the rain for daring to have his church open. We know what's going on in that country, which is certain to come here.
Well, they probably at some point when the pressure threshold gets too high for them to deny that these are not as they put on their website, the CDC website, safe and effective. And I quote, and by the way, those are technical terms in the FDA. You have to have a certain level of data that meets certain requirements to be able to use the terms safe and effective. I'm also worried that they are, because they're in control of this database, that they will begin to manipulate it. Look, Stu, we can't control everything. We have to work with what we have right now. And we've been warning people, thanks to your show and shows like it, we're bringing the truth. I'm going to stay on this issue of the blood clots and their relationship to these injections, because in our next regular segment, I'm actually working on what is probably going to be a bombshell report on the causality, the likely relationship between these injections and the blood clots. So it'll all come into focus. So don't miss that in the next our next segment together.
Dr. Jane Ruby, we always appreciate your time, making yourself available to us, giving us the most up-to-date information, and doing your diligence to make sure that you're being responsible with your language. It's really important to me on this platform that we are always in search of the truth, the gospel, because that's what lives and breathes right here at the Stu Peters Show. Dr. Jane Ruby, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Stu.
In a hurry to get out of here, we're limited to 1 hour, only about 10 seconds left. We want to thank Carlos Cortez and Cortez Wealth Management for being our premier sponsor. Don't forget to visit them online at CortezWM.com.